Hello, welcome to one of our 8 case study museum interviews for the AMM Essential Questions Program series. Over the course of this series, we're finding out how museums are faring today, 3 years after the start of the pandemic and civic unrest following George Floyd's murder. We will be chatting with 8 different museums across the Midwest about what they've learned about themselves and their audiences, what changes they have made that stuck, and what new models or approaches they have tried. These interviews are talk show style featuring guest moderators, and they're pre-recorded so that you can listen to them when it is convenient. And listeners will have the opportunity to ask questions of our museum panelists during live Q&A sessions later this spring. So stay tuned for that. Today's featured museum is the African American Museum of Iowa, located in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And today's interviewer is Richard Josie Jr., principal of Collective Journeys, and somebody who I love for coining the "what kind of ancestor do you want to be" a phrase that a lot of people like to say today. Richard, with that, I'm going to hand it over to you, and you can take it from here.
All right, thank you. And thank you to you all who I'm able to meet with today from the African American Museum of Iowa. I think first what we want to do is I would just love for you all to take a moment to introduce yourselves. Lanisha, if we could start with you.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm Lanisha Casello. I'm the Executive Director of the African American Museum of Iowa.
Thank you. And Felicity?
Hi, I'm Felicity Wolf, and I'm the Curator and Collections Manager at the African American Museum.
Thank you. And Brianna?
Thank you. I'm Brianna Kim. I'm the Deputy Director at the African American Museum of Iowa.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much. And thank you again for your time today. You know, one of the things that's really important to us is thinking about the impact of the last few years, especially when we're thinking about the pandemic, the multiple pandemics that took place over the course of time. And so I want to kind of start from this idea of getting a sense of what your new normal is like. And I think the first question that I'll begin with is, let's start with what's been new in the last few years, in terms of, you know, what's been going on there. And please.
So I was thinking that in terms of our program delivery, I think that even though there were some things that we were doing similarly before the pandemic, we've definitely increased our virtual opportunities across the state, which gives us more access and for content delivery. We've been able to expand our reach by having programs and presentations that have been available virtually. Even our big celebration or commemoration of Juneteenth, which before the pandemic was in person and probably reached maybe 300 on a good year. And then going to fully virtual in 2020 for a week-long celebration. Last time I checked, we had over 16,000 views. So in that sense, that's something that obviously we want to be back in person, and we have been for the last couple of years, but that hybrid kind of scenario has been something that we would continue to do going forward. We'll never really go back to doing everything only in person.
Mm. Understood, thank you. Actually with that, Brianna, I've noticed with many of the clients that I've had that, you know, this move to virtual in the operations, it had an impact in the operations. I would love to just know, like, what did that change kind of show you? Like, did it show you any new opportunities or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think aside from programming, which, you know, that was a huge shift before the pandemic, in terms of like a staff perspective, we were pretty much working from the office entirely. Remote work was basically like in an emergency situation only. We weren't really set up for that. We kind of had to scramble to be able to work remotely when the pandemic started. And I think, you know, kind of from a museum operations side, one thing that's definitely changed is it showed us that we could operate largely remotely. There were still some things that we had to come in and do in person. You know, you can't sign a check remotely and things like that. Well, I suppose there's probably a way to do that. But, and I think that's one lasting change that I think, similar to our program, hasn't really gone away. We are kind of still doing a bit of we're mostly returned to the office. But we have some employees that do like to work kind of a hybrid from home / in office schedule. And I think that has been something that's been a nice perk, I guess, that we've been able to kind of offer our employees. It's definitely been something that's helped when we're hiring some employees. We have one part-time employee right now that's, she is local, but is entirely remote. And that was you know, helped us when we were hiring for that position to be able to offer that as an opportunity. And I think that that's something I think I see staying for us as well, is that opportunity to work remotely as well as, you know, kind of in a traditional setting.
As a follow-up, like I notice a lot of organizations who have been able to make the shift to sustainably offer remote working opportunities, that what it's also done is it's expanded the degree of diversity that they might have within the organization. Are you all finding that there as well?
That's a great question. I don't know that I feel like the virtual option has really changed that much for us. All of our employees are still located in the Cedar Rapids area at the moment. We haven't really expanded to fully virtual remote option. Well, I mean, fully virtual maybe, but we haven't really expanded to kind of fully remote. Everyone that we have hired is still kind of local. So I'd say that really hasn't changed for us yet, but that's not to say it couldn't in the future.
Got you. No, thank you. Because that's a very interesting thing that I've noticed with a lot of clients and folks that I work with, is the potential that that has. What I don't know, and Felicity, this comes to you, is I'm always curious as to what sort of impact does that have with folks who are dealing with the objects, with the stuff? Like, how did that impact, you know, your world?
Good question. I'm trying to think back to 2020, and how things, well, we had, as a state, we had to shut down for about 6 months of time. But really, as soon as we were able to open back up again, we had people coming. Not to the degree, of course, pre-pandemic, but we had all of our items in place. We required masks and distancing like everyone else did, but it didn't seem to deter everyone from coming in. But I think that it did. I can't say that we really did a super job of trying to take the exhibit and turn it into a virtual tour through it. We didn't have that before the pandemic, and in order to get that going during the pandemic, and I don't know, I may be wrong, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. We do have a virtual tour of our permanent exhibit, and I cannot remember when exactly we had put that up, if that was in fact during the pandemic, so people at least had that option. But the temporary one, not so much. But the, you know, some of the virtual programming kind of made up for that. But it is hard when it is such a visual thing. You're right that the pandemic was just tricky, and it was when you can't access, you know, the office, and you can't have all those masking requirements and everything. It kind of just, we just had to rely on the programming, I think, a little bit more in that time. But like I said, when we were able to open back up again, people were willing to come back.
Right.
So I thought that said a lot for us, that people were willing to make the trip in.
Yeah, no, and that's certainly understandable on several different fronts. I want to open this up to all three of y'all, in that thinking about, you know, this moment of moving through the pandemic and trying to navigate this sort of hybrid of, having virtual experiences and then, you know, having people in person and kind of navigating that. Are there any things that you all learned about your audiences through that journey? I'm really curious as to, you know, like, what kind of new revelations, you know, did you all get from that moment?
I have a lot of thoughts. There are so many things that probably we're still even learning now. I feel like, as Felicity alluded to, that people were willing to come back when we were open. I think, you know, people were anxious to have a routine and to be able to go to those places that are safe and that were comfortable and familiar. And I think that definitely was something that was to our advantage, that we were open, and even though we had reduced, you know, we altered our hours, it was still something that worked. People were willing to come, and it showed us that we could still be able to be a viable resource and value to the community. Doing the virtual opportunities, I think, was definitely something, like I said earlier, that we will never really go back to not having those options. It certainly opened up the door to more new audience members and re-engaged maybe people who had been engaged prior, but maybe had kind of slacked off because, you know, life changes and you have new things that you're interested in. Your kids are a different age, or maybe you don't have kids anymore, or you have kids and you didn't have. So all these different variables certainly played into that. But I think the key for me was just being adaptable. You know, I think there's a lot of attention to what other institutions were doing. We would have our virtual meetings every week still. You know, what are the museums in town doing? What are the museums in the state doing? What's happening nationally? You know, maybe we weren't the first to do something that was new, but paying attention so that we could maybe adapt and do something similar. You know, we did our, not only did we do our Juneteenth virtual, we did our large fundraiser virtually that year. And we were one of the few organizations in town that were able to do that because ours falls later in the year. So some of my peers were having to cancel theirs because it was earlier, closer to the beginning of the pandemic, and you didn't really have an option. And so we were able to use our Juneteenth commemoration as kind of like a test to see if people would engage virtually. And that kind of prompted us to say, you know what, let's try to do this gala, this big fundraiser virtually. And it was successful.
I would say too, from my perspective, what happened in 2020 was our exhibit was on 21st century protest, and it was installed 3 months after George Floyd happened. And the outpouring of people to attend, I had an art event right before the exhibit opened, and the protests were going on in the city. And I wanted to have an art event. I wanted to have an experience where people could come and kind of vent their frustrations and their feelings in a cathartic way. But there was this concern about, well, okay, where were we? May, June, people still weren't sure about coming, you know, in person to things. And we were worried about the COVID issues. But the community, in regards to protesting George Floyd murder and things that have been happening in Cedar Rapids with people unhappy with the police department here, the community felt so strongly and so wrapped up in all of this that we had almost 100 people at the art event. Everyone masked, everybody sanitized, everyone kept their spaces, but they showed up for that. And ever since that exhibit, we have been doing nothing but contemporary topics because this is what people want to see. And I mean, we can get into that later, but that's what I saw out of the pandemic as well, is that we had a lot going on that year here in Cedar Rapids. We had the pandemic, we had our own protests with George Floyd, then we also had a derecho that we had to deal with as well, which caused problems in and of itself. But the fact that people were willing to come out for something to show their support, and I mean, people would come up from Iowa City, you know, they were going to be on their way to a protest, but they thought they would come and do a painting or whatever before they went to the next protest. And then everyone left. They could take it with them or they could leave it with us, and it became a whole wall in the exhibit, in the protest exhibit. And it's a really, really powerful piece of connecting with the community that was, I don't think we had in an exhibit to that point.
Yeah, I would just say also, I think kind of just to follow up on what Felicity was saying, I think the pandemic obviously changed a lot of things and, you know, lasting changes to the museum. But I think also what happened with George Floyd and the following protests, that was also a big event, and it impacted the museum in a lot of ways. We had a large outpouring of donations to the museum unsolicited right immediately following that. And I think that also prompted a lot of renewed interest in the museum, or introduced the museum to new people who perhaps didn't know we existed before. Mm-hmm. And I think hand in hand with that, the virtual programs help, because we've always considered ourselves a statewide museum, but in the past, pre-pandemic, that meant physically going to communities across the state. And Iowa is a physically large state. We're located on the eastern side, so there are communities that are 5-6 hours drive to get to. So we were able to reach more people that way. But I think also there's been an increased focus in a lot of companies on like DEI efforts. And we've seen a lot more an increase in requests for presentations from companies and corporations about not DEI, but like the history that we talk about as related to company DEI efforts. And that's, I think, a shift that we've seen in audience in the last few years as an audience we've gained. On the flip side, as a result of the pandemic, not related to George Floyd, school tours is something that I think, you know, if we're talking about, I think we've talked a lot of the good things that came out for us out of the pandemic in terms of like virtual programming, reaching more people. But one of the big challenges we've been facing is we used to have about 50% of our onsite attendance from school tours, largely elementary school students from the local area. And that has not returned with since the pandemic. Right now, which I'm sure we'll get into later, our building is closed because of a renovation. But even before that, we were not really seeing, we saw some tours, but they were more companies, smaller groups, more private kind of things. We have not really seen the school tours come back in the way that they were. And so we're still kind of trying to navigate, how can we still engage with the schools if field trips are no longer a viable option? Because they were always pretty guaranteed. We didn't have to do a whole lot to have those people, the teachers coming to us wanting to do the field trips. And we're still kind of trying to navigate that challenge, I would say.
Got you. Thank you. And thank you all for, because I was getting ready to start moving into some of the other pandemics. And so you all naturally, you know, moved in there. I think one of the things that I would be interested in is, you know, when COVID started to become a scare, you know, then when the fear started to kick in, and I noticed that many organizations, some of them were clients that I was working with at the time, they were not prepared for, and I don't think any of us were prepared for the storm that really hit us. So I'm curious about like lessons or learnings that y'all may have had, you know, looking back now. And I hate to ask, if you were to do it again, what would you do? So I'll just keep it straight to, what are some lessons that, you know, they can be draft thoughts. They don't have to be fully fleshed out, but are there any lessons that you all kind of, you know, wrapping your head around?
I would, jump in and say that from a personal perspective, our internal, we meet regularly as a team, and we're, like we talked about earlier, we're a pretty small team. I think one thing that became apparent was that we definitely need to listen to one another. You know, everybody had different levels of concerns regarding safety and caution and some of the guidelines and all those things. And really just, you know, not obviously our patrons were a huge concern, but also, you know, the comfort level of our team and our volunteers and things like that. So that's a big thing. I think that even though I think we have a pretty good working relationship, I think it really was kind of driven home that making sure that everybody's feelings and concerns are being heard. And I think that's something that I hope to think you guys can say if I'm wrong or not, that we've continued to do better at post-pandemic?
Go ahead,
Felicity. I was just going to say, I agree with that. I think there's been a new level of adaptability in the culture, more of attempting to understand everybody's work-life balance that I think wasn't there before, and to accommodate things. You know, most of our staff are working mothers. So, you know, there are other things going on in our lives besides work. And to have a culture that has recognized more of this adaptability, this hybrid kind of working as you need to, you know, that flexibility, work-life balance that I think has come out has been a positive of this post-pandemic.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think just from kind of an operations standpoint and thinking, you know, what I wish we'd done differently, I definitely agree. We were not prepared for the pandemic. And like you said, nobody was. Right. And I don't know that we could have done differently because we didn't know what was coming. But I wish we had been more set up to, you know, work remotely. But I do think that it also, in not being set up, it taught us to be flexible. And I think it also showed us that when we are presented with a challenge, we can jump in and we can figure it out pretty quickly. I mean, we were set up within a week to work remotely, whereas before, really our only remote capability was before was putting something on a flash drive or putting it on your Google Drive and working from there. We didn't have a way to, you know, like remote into our file server, and we were able to get that set up pretty quickly. And so I think while I wish we'd had that done before, because those first few weeks were stressful, trying to figure out like, how is this going to work? How are we going to manage? The good thing is it showed us that we can be flexible, and when push comes to shove, we can make change happen pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that, because I was going to say myself, like that was one of the beauties of not being prepared, was that it at least for many served as a test to figure out how do we deal with the challenges that approach us, which in many ways done well can create stronger relationships, you know, internally, but also externally. And it sounds like in listening to you all, is it fair to say that your relationship with the community strengthened over this pandemic time, you know, multiple pandemics? Is that fair to say?
I would say that. I mean, certainly there, you know, I think, I don't remember who said it now, but, you know, we had those, you know, one-time gifts. I don't know if we said it that way, but we had that influx of giving and all those. We had a lot of people reaching out to us, because all of a sudden, even though we've been here for a long time, people who either didn't know we were here or knew we were here, but didn't know why or what our purpose was, started to reach out about resources. Some resources that were like, okay, cool, we can cover that. And other times it was resources that were like, wait a minute. So there was definitely this trust factor that either was elevated or was new from members of the community, and people just kind of having this realization that, hey, the African American Museum of Iowa is not just here just as an amenity, but we actually have some value and resources that are beneficial to quality of life, knowing more, being able to be more open-minded, all of those things that, you know, come that are a part of being more aware of the culture and history of a certain people group and the communities that we serve. So that definitely was something that I can look back on and see the impact even still right now.
Gotcha. Thank you. That actually sets up for the next series of questions that I have, because if I understand correctly, you all are the only museum that's focused on Iowa's African American history. Is that correct?
That is correct. We're the one with we're the sole institution with that purpose. But you know, there are a couple of institutions that have a much more specific focus of Black history. But I would think that we're the only one in the state that has that preserves exhibits, teaches Iowa's full African American history.
Gotcha.
Right. Too.
So when we think about, you know, not only the pandemics. But more specifically with George Floyd and this overarching national concern in regards to relationships between police and people of African descent, and you all being the African American Museum of Iowa, like, I'm curious as to, there's something that someone said earlier in terms of, you know, starting to talk more about contemporary subjects. Like, is that something that changed? That was a change, correct?
It was a change. And it was a change beginning, first of all, when Lanisha came on board as the new director. There was a little more a desire to kind of push the envelope kind of thing. We were doing very, you know, traditional, very safe, almost survey type exhibits, temporary exhibits. I should say we have a permanent exhibit, which basically traces African-American history and African-American history in Iowa. Mm. And then we have a separate temporary gallery, and that's the exhibit that changes year to year. So what we what we have found, what we do is we come together as a staff and we have a list of potential exhibit topics and we kind of talk through them. And we also talk about, well, what are people talking about now? Because of course it changes year to year. And we come up with about three or four, we think, yeah, you know, this has potential. And then what we started to do is actually send out community surveys. Everybody in our contact database, we put it out on social media, any place we can to get the community's opinion. They rank them 1 to 4, 1 to 5, to get the community's opinion on what they want to see. And what we have found is since 2020 or 2019, actually, because I think the one on 21st Century Protest was the first exhibit that started this shift, is that people want contemporary topics. People just seem, and I don't know if it's just this Black Lives Matter and George Floyd has just brought about this awakening in the press and awakening in our society that, oh, we should start paying attention to these issues, and more people seem to be open to these ideas. So since the protest one, I mean, we just closed redlining, an exhibit on redlining. We currently have one that's entitled Suspended, which is systemic oppression in our schools. I mean, this is probably the most controversial one we've had to date. The redlining, we couldn't have gotten a better response on that one. I mean, people are like, are you traveling this? Is this going somewhere? This is great. You should have this up all the time, blah, 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 blah. People seem to be hungry for it. Those that come, we get, you know, very few who are unhappy with what we're doing. And that's strictly personal opinions. So that I think that's kind of rejuvenated us as well, because we're getting more press coming to talk to us. We're getting more, what else are we getting more of, everyone?
Collaboration. We're doing
more
a lot of
collaborations. Right.
We've always been collaborative, but I think this has definitely opened up doors to additional opportunities, not even just the obvious ones. People always want to say, okay, there's a Black play, so let's maybe talk about that. Like, we don't have to limit ourselves. There's all these intersectionality that we can, you know, be a part of. And so, and even when I think about when, listen, you mentioned the pivotal point with the protest exhibit, I think that was pivotal, but I think also the two before that, Untangling and Driven by Hope, were a little bit more contemporary than previous ones, but certainly protest was definitely, you know, a distinct shift. I think we're at the point now where when we have our meetings to talk about exhibit topics, it's like, okay, we were really edgy on this one. Maybe we should be a little bit more, you know, not as edgy. I like edgy. I like to push the envelope, but I don't do all the research and the work that goes into it either. So I have to get taken, talked off the ledge a few times.
Right. And see, and Brianna, I want to bring this one to you because you're looking at operations and staff and, you know, thinking about what goes into, you know, this contemporary work, you know, Nisha, as you were saying, like that takes a lot of work. I'm curious if you all are seeing like has this shift caused the work to be harder or maybe easier, or is it that simple? Like, how's it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, Felicity could probably speak more to if it's changed the exhibit development process. I have developed exhibits, but you know, to be honest, like she was saying, I was curator when we were doing some of those more safe traditional exhibits. And I think that was partly institutional culture at the time. And I think, you know, I did things like literature and the history of Black music and things that were a little bit safer. So I think it has definitely changed, and Felicity can probably speak more to the way that she develops exhibit. The research is a lot different when you're doing something more contemporary than when you're doing something where it's relatively easy to go find a few anthologies and some pretty, you know, sources that are pretty well established. I think from an operations perspective for the rest of the staff, I think it's probably our educator position is currently vacant, but I think it's changed their position quite a bit too, because we typically do programs that relate to the exhibit and the exhibit topic. So that's kind of shifted a little bit as well, the way that we kind of approach programming and programming topics. And again, we've had some renewed interest in collaborations and a lot more reaching out from companies who are interested in the topics we're doing and want us to present about them. And it's typically our educator who would be doing those presentations. So it's changed things a little bit for them. I think in terms of kind of from an administrative perspective, I don't feel like it's changed a whole lot, like for, you know, other than I think just as a, you know, an institutional culture almost, that the fact that we're kind of doing these exhibits, being a little more, I don't know, controversial with our exhibits has, right, I think, almost like opened up in the internal culture as well. Like, I think we feel very comfortable with each other. We feel very comfortable kind of talking to each other. We're comfortable talking about these kinds of topics. We know that we're not kind of afraid to push the envelope as an organization. And I think that that's made for kind of an opened up internal culture as well.
Thank you for that. Cause I think that's the real key part for me is, you know, once we start talking about things that are close to us, you know, in our current day, that it has the potential of opening up wounds and creating more distance and a struggle between folks. And to see that you all have been able to navigate and move through that is super. But let's see, I would love to get your take on that in terms of how that's affected, you know, in your exhibits. But just to give you a heads up, I'm hearing about this, I got to read this, suspended. Systemic oppression in our schools. So I just want to give you a heads up. I'm going to come to that one next. I'm dying to hear about that.
Well, we wanted to do something that was, you know, we started with school to prison pipeline and then realizing like every topic we look at, it's just massive. And I only have so much space and so much time, right? So I just focused on the public school system, and there's been so much talk just in Cedar Rapids alone, as well as in other places, Des Moines, Waterloo, you know, and the, in the nation, the controversies over having school resource officers, police officers in the schools. We've had instances of improper use of seclusion rooms, and just looking at how did public schools get to have these practices and policies in place that have caused severe and undue punishment to children, particularly those of color, and particularly those who are marginalized in other ways, like say in girls more than boys even. Those who are at the intersection of being of color and also in the LGBTQ community, and just kind of highlighting that, because those particular, especially SRAOs, are such a huge topic, but looking at, well, where did this start and why are we here? And that's what I kind of try to do in all of the exhibits. Like none of these issues exist in a bubble. It didn't all of a sudden just happen. What is the root of this? Mm-hmm. And so I go back to Brown versus Board, because that's when it all started. And governmental policies that have taken place that have infiltrated the schools and have caused control and, you know, racial biases that occur that disproportionately affect. And overall, to my knowledge, people are very receptive to it. But there are, you know, I tried to make an attempt to not, I didn't want to accuse teachers of doing, you know, I think some people feel like perhaps that has occurred in some way, which was not my intention. I was trying to show kind of like, well, here's what's in the schools, but here's where it goes wrong. You know, due to implicit bias, due to administrative policies, that sort of thing. So I was just in a facilitated discussion with a group and one of our board members, and it was quite a lively discussion, I will say. Someone disagreed with their wife was a teacher, and I get it. You know, it, of course, you're going to be defensive about things like that. But the conversation that went on was an important one. We kind of pushed these. Nobody wants to have an uncomfortable conversation about anything, right? None of us do. But to put that, to have an exhibit where people can read it, form their own opinions, get angry about it, get upset, get happy, get sad, get whatever, something in, trigger something in them that they can then go through in their lives, learn more about it, do something about it, even if it's something little in their community, in their own school, in their whatever. So when we have these controversial topics, then we have these uncomfortable conversations, and I appreciate that people want to have them because it's important. People are, you know, afraid to, but that's my goal with the exhibits, is to get people to just have an understanding of any part of that topic, you know, so that they can go about changing things about themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I think it's a beautiful articulation. I mean, I've always long thought that exhibits were the perfect catalyst for self-reflection. And in the course of dialogue, it's just a beautiful experience to be able to be in a space where I can share what my feelings are and at the same time receive the feelings that are coming from someone else. Like, that's how change happens. So I appreciate how you noted that. I'm thinking about change, and you all just launched a capital campaign. I would love to hear a little bit about that, you know, especially for many of the people who are will be watching this. Like, what prompted the campaign and what are your goals?
So the campaign launched as a result of the city of Cedar Rapids flood control system. So as a result of the 2008 flood, this has been long in the works. And so a portion of the flood wall is coming through the museum's parking lot. And so the city of Cedar Rapids did an analysis of the impact of the flood wall, the flood protection to our building, to our facilities and our operation. And, you know, it's a major endeavor. And so that alone was kind of prompted us to think about some of the other things that we could do to take advantage of this opportunity. If this is going to happen, it's going to cause, you know, road closures and, you know, major construction. Well, why not address some of the issues that our building has had over the last, you know, years, including a new roof, HVAC sprinkler, a facade, and all of the things that we knew that we could tackle with a project like this. So that's when we decided we needed to do a renovation project in addition to just the part that was impacted by the directly impacted by the flood wall. And so we launched that campaign last year. The city chipped in, of course, with a large chunk because of the flood wall. And then put together the building and steering committee campaign chair. And we've been, you know, touring the state with a large focus on Des Moines in terms of fundraising. And a part of that has been increasing our network and our visibility and awareness. And that's really done great. Our project goal is $5 million with an additional $1 million for our endowment. We just got to about 4.2 with a huge gift from the state, and we are set to present for another large contribution from the state next week. So things are going really well.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Thinking about that and, you know, kind of marrying that with what we've been talking about previously about these, you know, last several years and these pandemics, I'm curious as to if your experiences, you know, in the past few years, if that's shape this caused you to shape or adjust what your thoughts were about in terms of the types of things you want to do with the building.
Yes. Listen, there's not enough space to contain all the things I want to do.
Right.
There's so many things, but you know, I think because the response to our project and our campaign has been so positive, that's definitely given me a lot of thoughts on things that that I want to see for our future. The building reopening with some of the new features is going to be, I think, definitely transformative. And we're working right now on how do we maintain that kind of that novel feeling people will have when the building reopens, because it'll be a big buzz already. So we know we're going to get a lot of attention when we first open. How do we maintain that post-renovation, post-reopening? So that's something that's been on a conversation and some thinking that's been happening more recently.
Okay. Thank you. I got two more questions. Just two. First one, if you were able to offer any advice, you know, to other museum professionals who are sitting in your shoes, you know, through this type of situation, you know, what kind of advice would you offer them?
I think I would say be flexible. I think that's a natural answer after the pandemic, but I think also just in general, I've been at the museum for, it'll be 10 years this year, and physically it doesn't look a lot different quite yet, but it's going to soon. But in terms of like institutional culture, how the staff looks, how we do things, it looks a lot different than it did 10 years ago. And, you know, in some ways that's kind of scary sometimes, but in a lot of ways that's exciting. And I think especially over the last few years, I've just learned that you just have to be flexible and just, you know, not get stuck in the, like, we've always done it this way, so this is what's comfortable. But be open to new ideas, be open to the ideas of your team, of the community. And like really think about some of those things before you just say, oh no, that's, we can't do that. That's too hard. Or that's not how we do it here. So that's my two cents.
Okay.
I would say to all the ones creating exhibits who are now realizing that they need to have voices of marginalized people in their exhibits, don't be afraid to do it. Just do it. It's okay. I get many, many emails and calls from other institutions. Can you read this over? Does this sound okay? You're doing great. Just do it. Just have the other voices in your collection heard.
Okay. And I would add that growth sometimes takes risk.
Hmm. Yes. I appreciate all of that. Mm-hmm. My last question. If we had an opportunity to restart this whole interview, what would be one message that you would want to make sure that museum professionals across the country knew? What is one message that you would want to share out to museum professionals across the country?
Okay, so I have one.
All right.
I think cultivating your team, your culture internally is important. You know, I came in, I'm the new one still, even though I've been here for 7 years, but it's important. Everybody can look good on paper. People can be great, but know what they're doing. And I've been fortunate to have that. I trust everybody on my team because they all know what they're doing. They're great professionals. And I think that culture, making sure that is work. That the reason that what we do works externally is because it works internally. Mm. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is there another?
I go with what I previously said.
All right.
Push the envelope, people.
I'm with it. Any last words for us, Brianna?
Oh, that was a good question. I would echo what everyone else said to do a cop out, but I think also a little bit echoing what I said before, but just, you know, be open to new challenges, new experiences. As a operations person, as I'm sure many other operations people are, I am a type A personality. So change is sometimes uncomfortable for me, but just being open to that, I think is very important. And like Lanisha said, growth sometimes takes risk, and I'm not a risk taker always. I can be, but you know, taking that message to heart when that's not your natural inclination, but you know, having the team there to support you, I think is critical, so.
Beautiful. Thank you. I just want to tell all three of y'all, thank you all so much. I appreciate you all. Those of you all who are on the front lines of stuff, you know, consultants like us, we come, you know, on the back end. But those of you all who are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis in the midst of, you know, changes, national changes like this, I just want to honor y'all for the work that you all do and applaud you all, because a lot of people who don't do this work don't know the type of things that you all have to deal with whether you're on camera or when we get off camera. So with that being said, thank you all so much, and I appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.